It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Small game can be an entry for young people into hunting, but is also a tradition for sportsmen going back centuries and shows up in classic literature from all over the world. Big game trophies and freezers full of meat get the attention, but a lot of Alaskans target upland game birds and small mammals. It can be a low-key kind of fun that you can do with friends near town, or it can be an all-consuming hobby that includes raising money to improve grouse habitat. Today we're talking about small game, especially birds, how you can get into this kind of hunting, and what makes it interesting and enjoyable. And I have two guests who are hunters and amazingly knowledgeable about this topic, as I've learned as we were waiting to go on the air just a few minutes ago. Derek Tomlinson is with the Ruff Grouse Society, a board member, an avid hunter, and raiser and trainer of dogs, and sounds like it's a big part of your life.
It is.
Yeah. And Rick Marazon is with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's a biologist and program manager for small game, and also a dad who's been teaching young ones to start hunting. Rick, define for us exactly what small game is. I mean, we're essentially talking about just a few species, right?
Right. Yeah. According to fish and game regulations, small game, as we'll discuss today, includes grouse, ptarmigan, and hare. And there's a collective group of 9 total species, 4 grouse species in Alaska, 3 ptarmigan species, and 2 hare species.
And people are hunting for these critters all over Alaska in different cultures and for different reasons.
Correct. Right. They're regulated under multiple different sets of regulations, of which the state is among. But certainly they're harvested for many different reasons and absolutely traditions.
Yeah. So let's go through. Hare is different from a rabbit, and there's various kinds, but it sounds like the snowshoe hare is really the main one that people are hunting.
Right. Snowshoe hare are the most abundant hare species in Alaska, and they occur largely throughout the state. There's certain locations where they're much less abundant, but those are certainly the most popular hare species that are harvested. And then we have the Alaska hare, which occurs out in western and southwestern Alaska, that is generally much less abundant, but it's a considerably larger hare species than the snowshoe hare.
And then grouse and ptarmigan. There's like 3 species of ptarmigan, our state bird included.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Willow ptarmigan, our state bird, which is certainly the biggest and the most abundant statewide, and occur generally throughout the whole state with the exception of the Aleutian Island chain. And then we have rock ptarmigan, which is sort of our mid-sized ptarmigan that also occurs statewide, generally at slightly higher elevations, and it occurs out throughout the Alaska, or the Aleutian chain, excuse me. Uh-huh. And then the white-tailed ptarmigan, which is the only ptarmigan species endemic to North America, and that occurs essentially from the Alaska Range south all the way through south-central and southeast Alaska.
Endemic meaning it doesn't show up anywhere else.
It only occurs in North America, mm-hmm. Right.
And then grouse. And for a person who's very ignorant like me, define the difference between a grouse and a ptarmigan. I mean, what seems like when I am hiking, I'll see a bird that's fluttering along the ground, and I say, look, it's a ptarmigan or a grouse.
Right. Yeah, that's certainly a species identification is one of the big questions I get a lot. Grouse and ptarmigan collectively is a sort of a delineation, taxonomic separation. They have many similarities. Ptarmigan generally occur at much higher elevation, more of an alpine critter than a grouse. Grouse are generally forest dwellers or prairie dwellers.
Okay.
And we have 4 species, as you mentioned. We have the ruff grouse, spruce grouse, sharp-tailed grouse, and then the much lesser known sooty grouse, which is formerly known as the blue grouse. And that only occurs down in southeast.
And see, the spruce grouse is a really common one, yes?
Correct. Yeah, that occurs throughout the state. It's certainly far and away the most popular grouse species, not only in terms of total harvest, but total effort, hunter effort. And it's certainly the most widely seen and observed grouse when people are out walking their dogs and everything else.
And a lot of these, I mean, we're talking about really common species. I mean, that if you're lost in the woods and you're going to survive on your wits, your best shot is catching a ptarmigan, you know, or something like that, because they're really, really common. There's a lot of them out there, and there's no conservation issue in terms of them being too scarce or anything like that.
You know, certainly statewide, we don't have any major conservation issues relative to grouse and ptarmigan. There are very regionalized minor concerns on on, you know, what the effects of harvest are, where there is considerable hunting pressure. But generally, no, statewide, we don't have large conservation concerns.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that later in the show, talk about where to go and sort of where the hunters might have driven down the population a little bit. That's an interesting topic. But I want to talk to my other guest, Derek Tomlinson, who's with the Ruffed Grouse Society, and it sounds like a pretty avid hunter. And Derek, you were saying that you used to be a big game hunter and you kind of changed over. And I'm interested in what the attractions of this small, you know, hunting for these smaller animals and why you made that change.
Well, we have Springer Spaniels, and raise and train them, and that took me away from big game hunting to spending a lot of time walking in the woods. Also, you can hunt small game all the way to the end of March in this area, so there's a lot more time to be outdoors, whereas, of course, big game is essentially done and has been done for about a month in South Central.
And it seems like for the sport of hunting, there's more fun to be had. There's more time, like you're saying, and really, once you've caught a moose, you're kind of done hunting, right?
right. Yeah.
So what is the hunting process like with your spaniels?
First, a good breakfast, and then of
course you don't want them to eat what got you.
So, and then a nice long walk in the woods. Really, as far as hunting with the dogs, they course in front of you and off to the side, within say 40-45 yards. And when they make game, which can be a bird moving on the ground or in a nest, their tails will speed up, which gives you a pretty good idea that something's going to be happening. Then the birds will be flushed, and hopefully you'll be able to make a shot, and then the dog will retrieve the bird for you.
And they presumably smell the bird? That's how they know it's there?
They'll smell either air scent or foot scent. So a spaniel can do both very well. So if a bird's running, they'll actually have their nose on the ground, and that's a real key that are birds in front of them.
I'm just curious, with my own dog, I can barely get to come in from the yard, what kind of training you have to do to get a good hunting dog to do his job. Is it so inbred that it's kind of natural to them, or does it take quite a bit of time to get them up to snuff?
For retrievers or pointers or spaniels, it takes about 2 years to train a dog up to the level that, you know, they can reliably will come to their name and will not chase game and work with you as a partner. So it takes a bit of work.
But it sounds like, you know, from other hunters I've had on the show who hunt with dogs, it sounds like that's a sort of a major part of the sport and the enjoyment of it is this teamwork and sort of developing this dog to be able to do it.
It is. I mean, you have a dog at whatever range working with you as a partner, and that becomes really the central part of the outings, besides the breakfast, of course.
So how do you go about training a hunting dog?
Well, you start with bumpers, and then you graduate to using a bird wings.
I'm sorry, with what?
Bumper is something you can throw for a dog. So you use bumpers to get the dog to go pick up something and come back.
Oh, I see. Just sort of playing fetch.
Yeah, exactly. And then you turn around and begin using bird wings on the bumper. And over time, you work with it with the bird that's dead.
So you wings from birds that you've hunted?
Correct.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You save the wings.
And that's teaching them to go for that scent?
Correct. And so you can use the wings from geese or from ptarmigan or ruffed grouse or spruce grouse or sharptails.
I see.
Yeah.
And then you move up to using actual birds because you're trying to teach the dog not to destroy the bird before it brings it back.
Correct, right.
And how do you go about that?
Well, you know, typically you would just use a pigeon that you found someplace. And once the dog has picked up a dead bird of any type, they're pretty soft mouth. They'll bring it right to your hand.
So... Is that training part fun, or is that sort of just the what you have to do to get out and do your hunting?
It's really fun.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because you're seeing your dog sort of developing, you're developing that communication with
exactly.
The dog.
Their eyes just get real bright when they figure it out.
I bet they're excited when you take them out.
They are.
So how do you keep them? We did a show also on other, you know, hiking with dogs, and we talked about some of the issues that even well-trained dogs, they'll smell a bear or they'll smell something else, and they'll take off or they'll get in conflict with some situation in the outdoors. Do you run into those kinds of issues when you're hunting with your dogs, or are they so focused on the birds that that's all they can think about?
You know, they stay pretty close, and normally with the use of a whistle and your voice, they'll come right back. So if you want to bring a dog back, it's pretty easy to do.
Neat.
But that's conditioning. That's the training you've in the couple of years it takes to bring the dog to that level.
Yeah. And you're hunting mostly for grouse, it sounds like.
And yes, for ruffed grouse and for ptarmigan.
All right. So It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about small game hunting, which is, I'm learning, is about grouse, ptarmigan, and hares in Alaska. And I have two guests. Derek Tomlinson with the Ruffed Grouse Society is who you just heard from, and Rick Marizon is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game who handles their small game program. Rick, do you hunt with dogs as well?
I just got a new black lab about a year ago, so it's not a breed that is typically used for or thought of as a good upland bird dog.
More of a duck hunting
dog. It's more of a duck hunting dog, and that's sort of my secondary passion in addition to small game hunting. So it was hard for me, you know, to think of getting two different dogs training two different types of dogs or trying to specialize in one area. So
yeah, you need like a country estate and have like a kennel and right. your kennel manager right. takes care of all your dogs. Right,
right. But no, I do hunt with a dog, and I'm getting him out now on grouse and ptarmigan. In fact, I just went out last weekend hiking up in the just outside of Anchorage here looking for ptarmigan. So, you know, he's young, as Derek pointed out. He's just over one, and so he's still got a lot to learn. But the passion is there, and he's got bird fever, I think, worse than I do.
Mm-hmm. What about someone who doesn't have a hunting dog? How does this type of hunting differ for them, and how do they go about doing it?
You know, there's a lot of folks that hunt small game in Alaska without a dog, and there's a number of tactics that people use that are very effective at harvesting their daily bag limit or just even harvesting a bird. You don't need a dog by any stretch. It does improve your ability to cover a wider area over a shorter amount of time with fewer people. But certainly not a requirement.
Mm-hmm. So give me a sort of a sense or scenario of what you would be doing. Derek was telling us about how he does it with the dogs. How would you do it without?
Sure. Yeah, well, it depends on what species you are hunting, because the tactics may vary depending on the location that you're in. You know, for example, with ptarmigan, you're typically up in the alpine area, above tree line, oftentimes hiking ridges and kind of crowberry-covered slopes. Where you can, and many times, see the bird well in advance of your approach. So that's sort of one tactic that, you know, even one or two people can be pretty effective hunting ptarmigan. For grouse,
so this would be like up in the Chugach Mountains.
Sure. Yeah. For example, the Chugach Mountains are on the Kenai Peninsula or Denali Highway area.
Just get above tree line, sort of scan around, and just walk along and see if something moves out there.
Right. Yeah. Right. In the fall, for grouse, obviously they're more of a forest-dwelling species. And it's thicker cover. It's harder to see birds, whether they're on the ground or in the tree. They're extremely camouflaged. So that's where hunting with a dog particularly is advantageous. But nonetheless, I've hunted grouse many times without a dog. And, you know, you can certainly do it by yourself. Your odds of flushing birds does go down a little bit simply because you can't cover the amount of territory that a dog could. But if you go out with two or three other people, you can spread out shoulder to shoulder and kind of work down a trail system or across a basin somewhere and just cover a bigger area to hopefully flush those birds.
Mm. And so do you just make an agreement who's going to have the first shot or something, or how does that work?
Well, yeah, certainly it comes down to very good communication before you go out and before you even leave your vehicle and load your firearm as far as how you're going to position yourself. And I always recommend people wear blaze orange for that purpose, particularly when you're walking through a forested area.
Yeah.
You're dealing with firearms and moving birds that are unpredictable and you need quick reactions, and it is potentially a very dangerous situation. So you need to have very good communication with your hunting partners. But generally what we've done in the past is you just move kind of shoulder to shoulder and just make a line, and you can move through a forested stand, a timber stand somewhere. And just as you're moving through it, keep communicating and whistling or letting folks know where you are, and always sort of maintain visual contact with your partners. And so when that bird does flush, you know exactly where your partners are, and you're not going to swing your firearm anywhere near their direction. You know exactly where they are.
Hmm. Interesting. I think that would be especially important with kids, because they're going to be very excited.
Firearm safety and hunter safety is an integral component to small game hunting, whether it's hares, grouse, ptarmigan, it doesn't matter. It's a critically important piece of that puzzle. And whenever I talk to a group, that's sort of one of the first things I tout is just the importance and the value of firearm safety, mm-hmm. particularly with little kids that have no experience with firearms and no real, you know, a more of a limited sort of spatial awareness sense than many adults in some cases. So it's absolutely important.
Yeah, well, let's get into that a little bit more. If you're going duck hunting, you want to go out to the range and shoot some clay targets and get sort of tuned up that way, and that gives you a chance to sort of think about safety and being in that situational kind of space with the ducks rising. And how do you get your kids or your hunting partners tuned up before going out?
You know, I enjoy hunting with people that I know their hunting ability.
Right.
And that's another big component, is to communicate well in advance of ever loading your gun or leaving your vehicle, in terms of what's your experience, what do you have hunter safety, do you not, what's your hunting history. But certainly for kids, you know, with my son, for example, we've spent many days at the range firing a .22 and talking about constantly checking your safety and whether your gun is loaded or not, how to handle your firearm.
Turn that into a total habit, so you can't even do it without doing it.
Right? Instinct and just mm-hmm. reflex, mm-hmm. absolutely. So that when we're out, I know that when I give him a firearm, you know, he's going to be safe with it, and our dog's going to be safe, and it's going to be a fun experience rather than a scary or you know, worse experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Derek, do you mostly hunt by yourself, or do you take partners along?
No, I have partners, and when I've had young people with me, they've always have gone through the hunter safety program.
The fish and game lab.
Exactly.
Classes that
exactly.
they give, yeah. And we'll make sure we have a link to that on the website, so that folks can find out about the classes you guys give. I know those are excellent.
It's a great program. The Hunter Ed program for fishing game is phenomenal. They offer a whole myriad of classes, not only firearm safety, but bow safety. And, I mean, there's just a huge network of classes and mm-hmm. great instructors. It's a really well-orchestrated program.
Yeah, we did a show on that a couple of months back, and I was just amazed at the range of topics that they cover, and also the sort of the hands-on experience that folks get in mm-hmm. going out and actually
right.
doing some hunting and learning how to do it right. You were saying, Derek, that you taught a young person how to do this kind of small game hunting.
Yes, a young gentleman who at the age of 14 was began taking the hunter safety course.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about that course, which is I really like, is that every time that you go on the range, for every, you shoot once a week, they go through a whole procedure about where do you point your shotgun, loading the gun, wearing blaze orange. If you have a misfire in the gun, what do you do? I mean, that's repetitive every time. And the very beginning class, what really hit me was that was the first time all these young people had ever been introduced to the responsibilities of being an adult.
Hmm.
And that was made very clear. I thought that was a great point for the hunter safety people to make.
Yeah, putting responsibility in a kid's hand is the best way to get them to right. make more mature choices.
Right. So,
what is it? How long did it take before your young student actually had success?
You know, it took him about 4 or 5 outings before he got a rough grouse.
Was he missing, or was he? What was the?
He was very cautious in his shooting, making very, very sure he was safe.
Uh huh.
So there were times when he could have shot and he didn't, because he wanted to make sure he knew where everybody was.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I would think that the dogs would be in harm's way a little bit if you weren't really careful, because they're out there sort of flushing the birds and they're not wearing orange vests.
Right. Right. So, you talk with a young person and say, you can't shoot below the elevation of, say, the top of the trees or at least, above ground level, 5, 6, 7 feet in the air.
Oh, I see.
So, and, they listen real well. So
talk me through the dogs have just flushed the birds.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really need to make a really snap? You need to aim and fire really quickly in order to make that shot, right?
Right, yeah. With a flushing dog, like a spaniel or a lab that's flushing upland birds, it's real, real fast. And so hunter safety and, where your partners are, where the dogs is or dogs are all just critical components.
And I guess this is how Vice President Cheney ended up shooting his friend, right? That's what you don't want to do.
Right, right.
So how far away would the birds be when typically when you take your shot?
25, 35 yards. So by the time that the bird gets in the air, you see it, you recognize it, and you begin to move, they're going to be a fair distance away from you.
Mm. And so you'd be shooting with a shotgun.
Right.
And what gauge do you normally use?
It could be anything from a 12 to a 20 gauge, 16 gauge.
Oh, so you could use a large shotgun, but just use small pellets.
Right. Smaller pellets, exactly.
Is a larger shotgun going to give you a more probability of hitting the bird because you've got a bigger spray of shot, or does it? What difference does it make? I don't know.
It's kind of a trade-off. With a larger gun like a 12 gauge, you have more pellets. It also gets pretty heavy by the end of the day. So with a 20 gauge amount, you might actually be a little faster with a 20 gauge.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts. It's kind of a big topic too, and that's one thing we generally talk about in small game intro to small game hunting classes is just the link between shot size and the chokes that you can screw into the end of the barrel, and all of that affects sort of what you know the density of your pattern and the size of your pattern, and it's a fairly kind of a detailed subject, but certainly someone that's looking to get into the sport, there are a number of components with the firearm and the shot size that you use that can affect your the pattern that you.
Yeah, well, let's go ahead and get into it. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are hunters, and if they're not, they'll probably be impressed at all you need to know. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about small game hunting with Rick Marizon from the Department of Fish and Game and Derek Tomlinson from the Rough Grouse Society. So I don't know why, but when you talk about shotguns, the lower the number engaged, the larger the gun to start with. What are these modifications you're talking about?
Right, so shotguns typically range from anywhere from like a 10 gauge, which is typically used for geese and long range shooting, all the way up to a 28 gauge. Those are the most standard gauge shotguns that you'll find. A 12 gauge is it generally has a larger shell, typically more BBs depending on the size of the shot that you're using. Oftentimes used for ducks, very common for ducks and geese, but is periodically used for grouse. Mm-hmm. And then you advance to a 20 gauge, which is a slightly smaller, oftentimes lighter weight gun. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately a 28 gauge, which is even a much lighter gun. I guess I failed to mention a 410, which is another great firearm to introduce kids with because it generally has a very small shell and much less recoil than some of the other shotgun types.
What 410? What is the number? Why is that a different kind of number? Anybody know?
That I don't.
It's
know
one of those gun much, things yeah. We don't know. Okay, yeah, so. Good. I'm glad I got you on something.
Right.
Or something you guys don't know. So
look that up after the show.
Yeah. And what size of pellets do you use for these? These are the really small pellets you use, right?
For grouse and ptarmigan, I'd recommend anything from a size 7 to a 8.5 or 9, even depending on how close you're going to be shooting these birds.
And it's okay to use the lead ones? I mean, I know when you're duck hunting, you're only supposed to use steel.
For waterfowl, all migratory birds, you have to use steel. For small game in Alaska, you can use lead. It is legal. I generally recommend getting steel. There's some research that's come out recently in the lower 48, and many states in the lower 48 are moving towards steel only because it can cause lead poisoning from certain species with certain behaviors that do a lot of pecking on gravel trails and things.
Well, that's always struck me that shooting all this lead shot all over the woods, and lead is not good for the environment, and eventually we've got a lot of lead all over the place. I don't know. How does that strike you, Derek? Are you old school, stick with the lead, or what do you... The steel shot is quite a bit more expensive, right? And it doesn't really work quite as well, or...
Alaska is so big. I think in most cases that's not a real concern.
Yeah,
it could be in some real areas that are real concentrated. Mm-hmm. But when I'm out hunting with my hunting partner, I maybe 3 times a year find another person in the general area. So it's not too much of a deal most of the time.
We're not talking about large amounts of lead, right?
No.
Does steel have the same effectiveness as lead, in your guys' opinion?
I think steel is. Can be certainly as effective as lead was, for waterfowl or, mm-hmm. or small game. I generally do shoot steel all the way across the board, but I find it as effective. I have had to modify my shot size, but I've found it to be as effective, yeah.
To go for a larger pellet.
Right, mm-hmm. Slightly.
Yeah. So what do you use, Derek?
Well, actually, I use one of the gauges, which wasn't mentioned. I use a 16 gauge. Quite a bit. That's actually historically one of the very first gauges. So I have one I use for bird training, and then I have one I use for my ptarmigan and other hunting. So, but
you have two different guns for those different situations.
Typically, yeah. And I use anywhere from 7.5 to 8 shot. For all the upland birds. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I use 6, but that's fairly rare. I have to be hunting a ptarmigan where I'm making relatively long shots because the birds are flushing wild or getting up, you know, at 35, 40 yards. And then I'll use a slightly heavier shot.
So again, the smaller number means the heavier shot.
Correct.
Yeah. So right. I guess it has right. something to do with how many fit into the
That's correct.
Into the shell, yeah. right?
Yeah.
So a larger will carry you farther and you can get a more accurate shot.
Right. Right.
Rick, you were talking about some modifications or some adjustments you make to the gun?
Well, some adjustments in addition to the not only the gauge size that you purchase, as well as the shot shell size that you purchase, but you can also, on many shotguns, you can interchange what's called a choke tube at the end of the barrel, which affects the density of the pattern that's sprayed out in front of you. So you can, you know, if you're shooting skeet and targets that are fairly close and fragile, you're going to want to, it's sort of on one end of that spectrum, all the way up to shooting a large, maybe fast-moving, distant shot that's sort of on the other end of that spectrum. In terms of, you, generally when you buy a shotgun, or in certain cases when you buy a shotgun, you can purchase, or it comes along with about five different choke tubes mm-hmm. that you can screw in depending on the situation in which you're hunting.
And I mean, if total novices who are listening who are now getting completely intimidated, if you do the fishing game class, they provide the firearms for you to practice on, and they'll help you figure out what kind of gun you want to buy.
Right.
So you don't have to be, you know, terrified and walk into the sporting goods store and say,
No, and that's another, again, one more reason to take a firearm safety course is you get to, you know, in a very, in a much, much longer time frame, you get to discuss and learn and talk about the options that we're talking about right now. And really you can tailor what is going to be best for your desires and your hunting scenario specifically long before you ever go into a gun dealer.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody use rifles like 22s at all for this kind of hunting?
A lot of people do use 22s for both spruce grouse and ptarmigan. That's one of the more popular methods that people do use. And, you know, it's a single projectile. It is a rifle. It shoots one individual projectile as opposed to a shotgun, which mm-hmm. sends out a pattern of BBs. So your target, obviously, you want it to be stationary, and typically with spruce grouse and snowshoe hare and ptarmigan, there's oftentimes cases where they are stationary and you have shots that way. So that's a popular method for pursuing those species.
So give me the sort of the technique or the strategy for that style of hunting.
It's quite a bit different. As I said, the biggest difference is you're not shooting them on the wing,
You're
shooting them
stealth
either...
Stealth and being quiet rather than being intentionally noisy when you're trying to flush them, right?
Right. It's, yeah.
It's opposite.
It's a very different approach. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're hunting with a dog, you can afford to be... You can talk with your partner. You can whistle. You can kick the brush. Hunting with a 22, oftentimes... You know, you're exactly that. You're stalking and you're pursuing the bird and trying to shoot it before it flushes. Or if it flushes up into a tree, in the case of a spruce grouse, you know, you're waiting until that happens before you take your shot.
Hmm. That sounds hard.
It's a different tactic, certainly. Uh-huh. It comes with its own set of challenges, but yeah, it's just a different tactic.
And you need to have pretty good aim, I would think. So that puts me out. I'm going to get the biggest possible shotgun and just spray pellets everywhere. That's the only way I'd ever hit anything. So with Outdoor Explorer, we're talking about small game hunting, and we're going to take a break here for a minute. But when we come back, we're going to talk more about where you can go to do this kind of hunting, some of the conservation issues, and the work that the Rough Grouse Society has been doing to improve habitat, raising money to do that. And also, we haven't really talked much about hunting for hares. We've been mostly concentrating on birds, and I think that would be an interesting topic, too. So we've got lots more to talk about in the second half of the show with Rick Marizon from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and Derek Tomlinson from the Rough Grouse Society. But first, we're going to have a break. And down on the Kenai, small game hunter and author Christine Cunningham said she's come to trust the intuition of her hunting partner above all else when it comes to finding birds. Her partner is an English setter named Winchester. In the 5 years they've been hunting together, Christine and Winchester have logged some memorable days in the field, and here's one of their stories. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
We often go into the Kenai Mountains hunting ptarmigan, and we hunt behind a English setter named Winchester, and I'm sort of, he's 5 years old, so I've been hunting behind him for a few years now, and I sometimes get to where I think I know more than he does, and I'm wrong. We were up in the mountains early in the season, and he's, you know, searching. It's great to have a big running dog in the mountains up here because, you know, us as hunters, we can only cover so much ground, whereas if you have a big running dog, they can cover this whole area, and then you can, once they point, that's where you kind of use your energy to go. And well, I'd used all my energy to go that morning, and I'm with my hunting partner, and we're in this valley, and he, Winchester, runs 700 vertical feet up the side of this valley wall and goes on point, and we're just exhausted, and I'm like, ugh. You know, that's a long way to go. And so I go up there, and my partner's kind of keeping track with the GPS and timing and everything. It took me 25 minutes to get up to his point. And sure enough, the bird never moved, the Winchester never moved, but he did that thing again where he sort of, you know, doesn't move a muscle, but his eyes look at me like, what are you doing? Like, do I have to train you how to come up here a little bit faster? I mean, this needs to get done. I'm doing my part. He's just a really exceptional English setter, and he's black and white English setter, so he's spotted, and they have the feathers on their legs and tail, so they're very they're beautiful dogs. And when they run, it's like you could balance a book on their head. Didn't really have to teach him much, though. The breeding is so good for, his particular breeding was so good. It's more like, and just like that story, more like him training me. I love him.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your guest, Charles Woolforth. And today we're talking about small game hunting, which is grouse, ptarmigan, and hares. Our guests today are fish and game biologists Rick Marizan and Derek Tomlinson from the Ruff Grouse Society. And we're promising to reveal all the best spots so you guys can, like, you know, have lots of other people competing with you where you love hunting. But yeah. First, let's talk about some of the spots that are heavily used and that maybe are not the best places to go. I mean, are there some places that, because I know I have friends who, like, you know, do an after work thing or a weekend thing, or, you know, just a, you know, Saturday morning, you know, go up in the Chugach, and I imagine there's a lot of people doing that. So maybe it's kind of hunted over. Rick?
Yeah, you know, what we found both with our spring abundant surveys that we do every spring for grouse, ptarmigan, and hare, as well as just talking to hunters like Derek and other members of Ruff Grouse Society and just biologists throughout the state, the pattern that we've seen over and over and over again is that those areas that are very easy to access, whether it be through a gravel road or a established trail system, get hunted very, very heavily. And that's true generally statewide. So certainly the areas very adjacent to near Anchorage, the road system on the Kenai Peninsula, really the entire road system corridor all the way north to Fairbanks and beyond are hunted very heavily for obvious reasons. They're easy to access. You don't have to go through plan a major expedition like you do at moose hunting or caribou hunting in many cases. You just want to go out for a Sunday morning with your kid or your wife or whomever and go see if you can flush some birds or some hare. And unfortunately, many other people have that same thought. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the thing that the overarching comment I'd make in terms of where to go would be to, if you can and you're able, whether it's, physically walking or hiking or whether you have a snow machine or four-wheeler, is to try to get away from those really easy access corridors in hopes of finding higher density of birds or hare.
So if you go somewhere that everybody else is going, you just may not have success because you might not find anything.
Right.
Are there any ecological or conservation issues related to overhunting of those species in those areas?
We're in the middle of several research projects right now, just beginning to kind of explore that very topic. And what we're finding is that the densities of ptarmigan in both cases of these research projects is considerably lower adjacent to these road corridors and trail corridors that are heavily hunted versus those areas that are even 5-10 miles distant and are relatively inaccessible to most people.
So hike a little ways.
Exactly.
If you're able,
get off the darn road.
I mean, whenever folks call me to want to know where to go, that's certainly one of the more popular questions I get at fishing mm-hmm. game. Where can I go? And I always suggest if you're able, get off the road and get off the trail and bushwhack a little bit and climb the ridge and go over the ridge and your odds of finding birds and having success will improve dramatically.
Well, and it's like you're not doing this to feed the family, right? You're doing it for recreation anyway. So why not get out and use a little bit of energy?
Well, and it depends on the location of the state. Many folks in Southwest and Western Alaska are actually harvesting ptarmigan in large numbers, and those are considerable portion of their diet. But certainly here in South Central, many folks, it is more of a sport and recreational activity to do on a weekend or a day off.
I have a feeling there's not a big shortage out in Southwest Alaska.
It's an interesting phenomenon out there. There are very abundant populations of ptarmigan, particularly. Mm-hmm. There's a considerable amount of hunting pressure
near the village.
Near the villages.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, away from those villages, there's, it ebbs and flows certainly throughout the years. But generally speaking, there are considerable populations of ptarmigan.
Right. So, Derek, how far from town do you go when you're hunting?
Within, say, 45, 50 miles, because normally I come home at night. Mm-hmm. And lots of times where I start off is at a fairly popular access point. And once I'm a quarter mile or less off the road, I'm by myself and generally finding birds. So really it's a matter of just walking away from the trails.
So do you think that this phenomenon that Rick's talking about is maybe a little bit of laziness on people's part, that they're just not walking far enough?
Well, the trails are pretty easy to use. They're handy. And some people can't get off the trails, too.
Uh-huh.
So, as a matter of course, if you can leave the trails, you'll find birds a lot more readily.
Yeah. Are you primarily going after grouse or also ptarmigan quite a bit?
Mostly rough grouse, but also some ptarmigan.
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of out in the woods, and so you kind of need a trail to make much distance when you're after grouse? True?
No, once you leave a regular trail system and just, as Rick said, bushwhack across the country, you'll find spots where grouse are being held.
Uh-huh.
So
do you normally head up to the valley or down to the peninsula? Or I know you probably don't want to give your precise favorite spot, but
it's worth a lot of money.
Give us a sense of where you like to go.
Well, let's just say it would be in the Palmer area and all the way up towards Eureka.
Mm-hmm.
And then over towards Point McKenzie. So it's, the size of Vermont, if you will. It's a pretty large area.
Do you have to watch out for land ownership or in terms of not getting on private land, or is it okay as long as it's not posted?
I hunt on state land almost exclusively, just to avoid that. So, you find like on the Moose Range or land that's not posted that is either state land or at least not posted, and then you're pretty good to go.
Yeah. And it's sort of like you're looking for where other people are not, right? I mean, you're not looking for where other people are. You're looking for where other people are not.
Typically, correct, yeah.
Have you ever noticed that when you're fishing, and there'll be somebody fishing and everybody thinks, oh, that must be where the fish is. I'll go there too.
Right.
No.
Right.
That's the thing. This phenomenon we're discussing here is not unique to small game. It's certainly, you see it, on some of the more popular fishing creeks.
Roadside streams are just out.
And moose hunting and caribou hunting, and it's a pretty common phenomenon.
But, I've been up... up in the interior when you know, season will first open, and you'll see people just cruising down the highway hoping to find a caribou or a moose right next to the road so they don't have to carry it very far. And it's just a different, I think it's just a different sort of way of looking at this, right?
Right.
I mean, whether it's sort of a sportsman that you're doing for recreation or somebody who's just trying to get some meat.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, but these birds are good eating, right? And you bring them home, and let's talk a little bit about that, about how you process them and how you use them. Derek, I mean, what is your, are you putting this on the table quite a bit, putting grouse and?
Well, no, not really. I mean, mm-hmm. if you take 10 or 15 grouse, rough grouse in the course of a year, that's actually a pretty good number. So, you know, but you take a single bird to feed two people.
Right.
And so, you know, when you take the meat and you saute it in an oil with maybe a little bit of seasoning, it's delicious.
Yeah. So you could, so what's the process for actually taking care of your kill and getting it, you know, getting it to the table?
Basically, take the crop out right away. And
you do that in the field then?
Typically.
Mm-hmm.
And take out the innards from the cavity so it cools off.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll come off, you know, once you use a knife to take it off the breastbone and save the legs, it'll come off quite easily.
Mm.
So,
and I might add too, we have both hare and grouse and ptarmigan field dressing instructions on our small game website on the fishing game homepage. So if folks are interested, we have full color photographed and step-by-step instructions on how to actually field dress these critters too.
All right.
Right.
So and all these websites we're talking about are going to be found at alaskapublic.org. Just look at it at today's show, Small Game Hunting, and you'll find all the links and you can go right to them. I'm interested in what the kids' reaction is when you're teaching them to hunt. I know both of you guys have taught kids to hunt. I've certainly taught kids to clean fish, and some of them go for it and some of them don't. Right? Derek, what was your experience with that?
Well, the young gentleman that I had with me, a gentleman, Hunter Root, was very excited to finally have a bird. He'd been out, like I say, 7 or 8 times before he had one.
Uh-huh.
And I showed him how to do so on some of the birds that I had shot prior, and I handed him the knife, and away he went. He was quite handy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it's really not that hard. Once you just have to not be too squeamish.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Rick, what was your experience?
Well, my kids, for example, they loved it. They absolutely. I've taught them, or we've cleaned salmon over the years with them, and mm-hmm. they've really enjoyed that. And whenever I bring home ducks or small game to the house, my kids think it's really fun. It's just, you know, kind of biology 101. You can talk. I mean, it's a great mechanism to talk about a lot of interesting topics. You know, you can talk about all the organs and mm-hmm. the structure of the feathers and all that sort of thing. You can really expand it more than just kind of trying to get over the squeamishness of it. It's
right.
You can really talk about a lot of topics.
And my insight on this is that the earlier you do this, the better success you're going to have, because little kids think it's fabulous. You know, oh, what's that piece? Is it a male or is it a female? You know, and so on. And then when they hit their sort of their middle school years, ew, that's gross. Right. Yuck, you do it. I've got to watch TV.
Yeah.
So,
that's true.
Yeah, get them into it early. We haven't talked about hare and the where you do that kind of hunting. Rick, give us a little bit of a primer on that.
Sure. Yeah. What you're looking for hare, you typically when you're going out, I would recommend folks, a lot of people focus their effort in the wintertime. And there's an advantage to doing that in that the hares use what's called a run, and it's a sort of a highway through their habitat. And when hares will use the same run over and over and over on their nightly or daily movement. And as a hunter, you can find these runs. And generally, when you are in an area with high densities of hares, you'll find a very well-packed run through a willow, you know, stand or some heavy cover typically. And so as a hunter, again, that's the one thing you really want to look for. One hare can lay down a lot of tracks over the course of 4 or 5 or 6 days since the previous snow event. And so a lot of folks will go out and see hare tracks running through the snow, and they'll think, oh, there's lots of hares here. But in reality, it's just one. And there was a week since the last snow, and you know there actually aren't that many hares. Right now, unfortunately, in South Central, we're at the absolute, probably what's going to be the absolute low for the hare cycle. It's a very predictable, about 8 to 10 year cycle.
Boom bust. Yeah.
Very. It's kind of the epitome of boom bust in the wildlife world. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we just enjoyed the benefits of the high about 3 or 4 years ago, and now we have to suffer through the low for a lot of people that enjoy hunting hares.
Which is a natural cycle. Doesn't really have anything to do with hunting. It's just the way that their populations will grow, and then they'll be overpopulated and they'll crash.
There's a lot of components that go into mm-hmm. that cycle, and frankly, there's been a staggering amount of research that's gone into trying to understand what exactly causes that, and there's still a great deal of disagreement about what specifically causes it, but it's likely a myriad of factors. And so, no, it's very likely not an effect of hunting. It's more of an effect of avian predators and disease and secondary defenses from plants. I mean, a whole number of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about small game today, and my guests are Rick Marizon from Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who was just speaking, and Derek Thompson from the Rough Grouse Society. Rick, we were just talking about some research on hares. I know you have a wing collection program where hunters are sending in wings. Is that part of your research?
It's not so much research as it is just it dramatically improves our ability to understand the demographics of the hunted populations of grouse and ptarmigan. It's a statewide program. It's entirely voluntary for those that are hunting small game. There's nothing required about it. But we do provide free wing envelopes, as we call them. They're 9x6 Tyvek envelopes. And all we're asking for is one wing and a head for ptarmigan and one wing and a tail for grouse. And when we get those samples, we can determine the age and sex of that particular sample. And if we get enough samples from that species in a particular location, we can actually estimate the demographics of that population. We can estimate juvenile production from that population, how productive they are, or how productive they were, I should say, from the previous year. And it's a suite of information that we would otherwise not be able to learn about these critters. And it's proving to be very enlightening in terms of, you know, the proportion of juveniles that are harvested in the fall. And so it's proving to be very, very productive. And
so I don't get that, because it seems like you wouldn't know what percentage were being sent in from the percentage that were being shot, or is that not important?
That's right, and that's why we have you know, certain sample sizes that we try to achieve from particular locations mm-hmm. for each species. So obviously, if we only get, you know, 3 spruce grouse samples from the Anchorage area, we're really not going to be able to learn much about that. But you know, in many cases, for example, the Denali Highway with ptarmigan, we're getting 300 and 400 samples a year from that population. So that's a pretty significant sample size.
So a lot of hunters are going along and helping out with this.
It's been very well received by those that have participated. And one thing we do try to do to encourage future participation is I do let and our biologist in Fairbanks, Cameron Carroll, we try to let folks know as soon as we look at those samples so they know what they harvested.
Uh-huh.
And they know that this data isn't just going into a big black hole somewhere. And then at the end of the year, we write our annual management report on essentially the status of small game, everything we do know about small game in the state. And we mail them a complimentary copy of that report as well, where that data is actually expressed and documented.
Interesting. So have you been doing this, Derek?
I have been, yes.
So yeah. Where do you get the envelopes? Just go down to the fishing game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
And we'll also mail them to you. And
okay.
We also have postage paid return envelopes so that folks don't, we want, you know, no skin off your back if you want to participate. So
you can order them off the website and they'll just call me, email me.
Yeah. Or you can go to any fishing game office and pick them up.
Again, those sites are all on alaskapublic.org. So, Derek, so you just, you get the bird, cut off the wing and head, and just pop in the envelopes, not much trouble.
That's right. Yep.
And then you get those reports back. Are those pretty interesting?
They are. You get it back in about 10 days from when you turn the birds in, typically.
And what kind of thing are you getting in when that comes back?
You know, it's a thank you for sending it in, because, you know, it has become, you know, a compilation, but at least you know it's been received and being looked at. So, yeah.
You're an experienced hunter. You probably have no difficulty in recognizing the different species.
The species, no, but of the ages of the birds, it's still quite difficult. A bird of the year is very more difficult because of the way the feathers develop and before the first molt.
Huh.
So
that's interesting information to receive from a trained biologist.
It is, right.
Oh, that's neat.
So
tell me about the Rough Grouse Society. What do you guys do?
Well, our organization has been in Alaska for 23 years, I think it is, and nationally for about 52 years. And since its founding here, We've been involved in a lot of modification of lands on state, I should say state lands of modification, for creating a successional forest for rough grouse habitat. A lot of the forests have been for 60, 70 years old and are of one stage. So up in the Palmer area, there's been almost 15 years, 13 years of development of where parts of the Moose Range have been cut. And then over time, the successional forest comes back in. And in some cases, we've been able to build a trail system which links some of the oldest cuts together. And we're still building that trail system, as a matter of fact, so that the general public can take a walk along moraine ridgelines and see different types of habitat and different parts of different stages of development and find rough grouse.
So those are trail systems that you can sort of use to access some of these really good habitat for
That's hunting. Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where do people find out about where the trailheads are and how to access those spots?
I'll have that information for maybe on the website with the GPS coordinates.
Okay.
It's a pretty convoluted way to get to where the trailhead starts.
Right.
So that's the best way.
So when you talk about enhancing habitat, the grouse really like the new sort of brushy habitat. They don't like the older trees. Is that?
It takes about 15 years before you see the habitat come back, or 12 years before you see it come back where a whole lot of grouse.
Interesting. So this is something where it's conservation for the future. It's not something you enjoy right away.
Right.
But you've been at it for quite a while.
Right. We have been, yes. So
I was noticing on the website that you've raised a lot of money, so you must put some effort into that.
We have raised quite a bit of money. We've had quite a bit of donation money also from ConocoPhillips and others to help us in the trail building, which has been very helpful. Mm-hmm. So,
Rick, I mean, in the sort of the normal course of things, I guess these forests would have burned and then they would have succession, but maybe there's been less fire, or maybe we're just helping things along. How does that work?
Right. Well, you guys were talking specifically about rough grouse. Spruce grouse are more of a mature forest dweller, a mature spruce and birch forest dweller. But for rough grouse, they were brought down. They were introduced back in the late 80s, early 90s from native populations in the interior. And in the interior, obviously, as we all know, that environment is much more prone to fire naturally. And so you get these big fire events that do create these very widespread successional events, and rough grouse have benefited greatly from that in the interior. Here in South Central, it's a little bit wetter environment, more of a maritime environment where fire is not as big of a component on the landscape. So that's where the work that Rough Grouse Society is doing down here is really proving to have some benefit for rough grouse.
So what does it amount to when you say you're sort of cutting down some of these older spruce trees?
And the whole forest, spruce trees and birch, and then maybe all the larger trees would be felled.
Huh. One thing we look for when we go out and try to identify a cut unit is a component or at least a percentage of aspen in that stand. And what happens with aspen is they're known for suckering, which means that
they propagate through the roots.
They propagate through the roots, exactly. So if you go in and delineate a cut that has a component of aspen in it, you'll generally get that young, very rapid, early successional aspen in that stand, which is one of the preferred browse species of rough grouse.
So these birds were introduced, and it sounds like they've done quite well for not being natural here. I guess I'm curious as to why they're not endemic in this area.
They have done reasonably well. When they were introduced back in the late 80s, it was they planted them in around Willow and Palmer. And since that, they've had just tremendous range expansion. They now occur all the way down West Cook Inlet, all the way up to and beyond Talkeetna, all the way out the Yentna River, Squintna, and then up the Matanuska River Valley, almost all the way to the Matanuska Glacier, and then down in, and even I've heard one report beyond Anchorage. So they've essentially filled up all potential and available habitat in South Central that is appropriate for rough grouse. What we have not documented, however, is a large increase in overall abundance. There are localized pockets that have higher densities than others, and typically that's where the habitat is more preferable for them. But regionally wide, they're not as abundant as they have been up in the interior.
There's something about our habitat they don't like quite as well.
Much of the forest is quite mature, so it's not going to hold a whole lot of birds.
I see.
So, and that's where walking is so important. because you may have to walk a quarter mile or a half mile from one spot to the next. When you get to the spots that have the aspen and the other types of cover for the birds, then you'll typically find the birds.
Mm-hmm. Rick, I just have to ask, because I know listeners are going to be thinking it, we hear all the time about don't introduce species, you know, the issues with pike in our lakes and the invasives and so forth. How is it different bringing a species like rough grouse in, and how is that kind of decision made?
That was well before my time, and mm-hmm. This is getting a little bit off my area of expertise, but I would venture a guess that introduction to the valley now in the mid to, 2014 would very likely not happen, or if it did, it would be considerably more politically volatile than it was back in the late 80s. Fish and game is generally, that whole process is looked at much more seriously than it, not to say that it was then,
but it doesn't sound like there's been any harmful side effect that you've seen.
There's very little, it appears as though there's very little competition between rough grouse and other mm-hmm. species that it commingles with. Mm-hmm. So that was one benefit to bringing that particular species in. Whereas like with pike, it's a
disaster.
Ravenously carnivorous species in a salmon stream that with salmon smolt that are essentially defenseless.
Yeah.
That is a very, very different situation.
Right. And it sounds like it's a really prized game bird.
It is. And one of the things that I've noticed over the past 20 years of hunting rough grouse is the number of avian predators. 1990-92, there was very few predators you'd see in the course of a walk. And mm-hmm. it's not uncommon in a walk to have a goshawk pick up a bird from someplace else and fly, in your view shed. You go, wow, there goes a grouse. So I think the predators have done well on the avian side with the introduction of the rough grouse.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got a little time left. What's the season for this hunting? It's still going on right now.
It is, yeah. It varies throughout the state, but generally it starts anywhere about mid-August, and it goes in many places through at least late March. And in portions of the interior, it goes through late April, and in portions of the extreme west and southwest part of the state, we have one season that goes even through May. So they're very liberal seasons, and generally speaking, very liberal bag limits. And all the species do have a season and a bag limit. So that's one interesting feature over other states of the union that with small game that have very restricted access to certain species.
Yeah, this is the place to be in so many different ways. Well, I want to thank both of my guests. It's been an interesting conversation. I've certainly learned a lot. Of course, I started from a pretty low level. So I want to thank Derek Tomlinson, who's a board member with the Rough Grouse Society. Rick Marizon is with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's a biologist. And thanks very much for being here, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll have a studio full of outdoors filmmakers to talk about their craft and how they tell stories of Alaska's great outdoors and all the amazing activities they go out and document in their films. Thanks for joining us today for Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Goki, and I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.